Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. There's a perfunctory bit of holly superimposed onto the corner of the masthead of the Business Post, but I'm afraid, apart from that, there's nothing massively Christmassy about the front pages of the papers today. So the Business Post is leading with EU must do more business with US to get Trump on side. That's from the Taoiseach. So we have decided to get in line behind Macron, behind Zelensky, behind the denizens of Silicon Valley. And obviously the strategy is going to be let's suck up to Trump. The only ones not sucking up to Trump at the moment are actually a lot of people in his own party and in the MAG, who seem to be having a kind of a belated revolution against him at the moment. The Sunday Times is leading with McGregor's ilk hijack our faith, says Archbishop. And this is Eamon Martin, the Archbishop of Armagh, who is the leader of the Catholic Church in Ireland. And he has called out people like Conor McGregor for hijacking the faith by using religion to influence their followers. And you will have noticed, if you keep half an eye on these things, that Conor McGregor has started invoking God and the cross and stuff a lot in his recent outpourings. The Sunday Independent is leading with photos from phone give Gardaí proof of Cairn's last known location. So you will have seen those new pictures that emerged during the week. But what is interesting about them is that so the last confirmed sighting of young Ciarán Dernan was May 2022. Now that there are photographs of him in June, it means that the focus of the investigation actually shifts from that. So that's progress, I guess. And the Sunday Mirror indeed has that the funeral of Ciarán Dernan murder suspect Anthony Maguire took place in a private ceremony yesterday. The Irish Sun on Sunday is leading with the Christmas market massacre in Germany. And they are saying that the Christmas market killer had threatened to slaughter innocent people months before the horror car attack, which left 5 dead and a further 205 injured. And indeed, there is more and more coming out about this guy, and none of it simple. A very complicated individual with a complicated palette of political views. And it does seem now that Saudi Arabia, whether it's propaganda or not, are saying that they had warned the Germans about it. Other people coming forward saying we had pointed to stuff that this guy was saying on social media. And obviously this is all now feeding into also a very febrile political atmosphere in Germany, where the right-wing party AfD have a lot of momentum at the moment. Germany is in a very important election campaign. So this was, you know, apart from the terrible tragedy of it, the worst possible time for something like this to happen. The Irish Mail on Sunday is leading with a story about a complaint upheld in the Workplace Relations Commission in relation to Verona Murphy's time in the Irish Road Haulage Association and a subsequent non-disclosure agreement that was made about that. And the Sunday World is leading with the story that Graham Dwyer is being moved apparently to a stricter part of the Midlands prison. Okay. Our panel this morning, Mick Clifford is a special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Lorna Fitzpatrick is Public Affairs Accounts Director at Instinctive Partners. Dr. Emily O'Connor is a consultant in emergency medicine in Connolly Hospital. And Barra Rowntree is an economist in Trinity College Dublin. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming in on this weekend before Christmas. Mick, well, we start with a bit of politics, and Shane Ross has a piece in the Sunday Independent about Michael Lowry's triumph, I suppose, is all you could call it.
Very much so. Michael Lowry, the old dog for the hard road, if you want to put it that way, he's very much practiced in politics, but we also know he has another history as well, which was laid bare by the Moriarty Tribunal in terms of his dealings in relation to when he was a minister and giving out the mobile phone licence and what have you. And there was some very severe criticism from there to the extent that Fianna Fáil called for his resignation from the Dáil. This was all 12, 13 years ago when that came out. However, he is now apparently a pivotal figure in putting the government together to this extent that he is the main, it would seem, the coordinator of the independent group. And it was through his instigation that Verona Murphy was proposed for the Ceann Comhairle. Mm. Now, the first issue that would arise there is, you know, in terms of the Ceann Comhairle, normally you'd be talking about someone that A, has a lot of experience, and B, would be regarded in some ways as being not particularly partisan or anything, and would be able to do that job without fear or favour.
Which
so to
Verona
speak.
Murphy promises she will do.
She promises she will, and she should
even,
be given every chance
in an
to do so.
Tempered manner.
Absolutely.
As well.
But the only point I'm making about it is not on her character as such, but on the premise that she was put forward by others and agreed to by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, which was effectively, as has been reported a number of times, to take her off the pitch. In other words, because she was the person seen as having the most ability in that independent group, but also somebody who could quite possibly be very strong-willed should issues arise, and therefore would be seen as a weak link in terms of holding the government together, because, you know, for
so
very
back
good
to the stability,
exactly.
The great excuse for everything that's happening
exactly.
Right
so
now.
For those reasons, it would appear that she was put forward. Michael Lowry got that into place. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael saw that it coincided with their interests, and that was the reason for doing so. And one column about
the backbenchers of Fianna Fáil certainly didn't all seem to agree it coincided with their interests when you look at the votes.
Yeah,
they didn't do what they were
told,
did they?
No, definitely. But the point being that once Simon Harris and Micheál Martin put it to their respective parliamentary parties, they got enough votes to get her over the line. But there's no question, why would backbenchers in either party, unless they wanted to curry favour with their leader or whatever, why would they go along with that? And quite obviously a number of them didn't.
Yeah, and you could also say you went along with it maybe and not go along with it, couldn't you?
There's talk of photographs of the ballot paper being passed around and shown to the leaders or what have you. Back again, of course, to the famous one with Albert Reynolds and Bertie Ahern and showing him, and somebody turning around to Albert and saying, well, that's you finished once he's done that.
Bertie
kind of
showed Albert that he had voted for me. So whatever happens now, Albert, not my fault.
And someone else turned to Albert and he says, well, when he did that, you're finished. one quick thing. Alison O'Connor is a very good piece, and she makes another point about Ron Murphy, and you're right, give her every chance. She's a person of a lot of ability.
Before we get to Alison, we'll come to that in a second, okay? Just some of the others have picked that as well. Lorna, can I bring you in on that? Shane Ross really does paint a picture of Michael Lowry as all powerful and the two leaders of the two biggest parties, the biggest party and the third biggest party, completely capitulating to him.
Yeah, look, and I think Mick's commentary on it and the commentary in the paper today is very much the case that, you know, she was seen as a threat to, Verona was seen as a threat to the stability of government. And I think one quote in Shane Ross's piece was that Verona is trouble, she fights with her own shadow. So I think that in and of itself shows that they were trying to remove her from any potential discussions, whether it comes to the formation of government or whether it comes to the stability of government when they're in place. But what I do think is interesting, and obviously I'm from Wexford, but I'm from this new Wexford Wicklow constituency, so Verona isn't my TD.
Okay.
But obviously Verona would have been my TD in the last Dáil, for example. And obviously when she ran for this election, it wasn't on the cards that she was going to be Ceann Comhairle. You know, that wasn't ever a suggestion. And she very much ran on the ticket of holding the government to account. And delivering for Wexford. And now there's realisations, I suppose, starting to land. And I see our local papers down home kind of commenting saying, oh, well, hold on now, this means that she's neutral. This means she's politically neutral. She's removed from fighting for Wexford or holding the government to account
Has assured local radio down there that being the Ceann Comhairle gives you great access.
Which is really unusual given that, like, I suppose that the whole premise of the fact that, you know, you're automatically re-elected in the next term is because you're taken off the pitch when you are Ceann Comhairle. So I don't understand how those two things are going to work together. But I wish her the best of luck in the role. And obviously, look, a first female Ceann Comhairle is something that I think has taken a long time for us to get here. But I wish her luck. I just wonder whether she'll be able to be all things to all people as she's presented.
You were looking at that piece as well.
Yeah, and I think just it does demonstrate that it looks like Michael Lowry is the power broker standing in the background pulling a lot of strings here, and you don't always have to maybe be in a ministerial position to do that, and he's demonstrating that very, very effectively. But there is maybe some questions around what kind of government we're really going to get over the next 5 years, mm-hmm. if it is going to be this type of government where we have have a bunch of independents with Michael Lowry pulling the strings, determining things. Because, you know, in all of these constituencies, there's issues which are no more or less necessarily than other areas, right? So the need for a local health centre, the need for a road, the need for a community centre. This is true across the country. But what we're clearly going to see over the next few years is that the constituencies that happen to have an independent that are part of this bloc are going to get a lot more. They're going to get a lot pork barrel.
So we should all be voting for independence.
Well, if we all did that, then with how many constituencies we have, I'm not sure we get any government at all. But I think this illustrates one of the difficulties that we're going to have and the kind of coherence of the next government, you know, that we have now. Two parties which have shown themselves to be able to work very well together, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, over both the last 5 years and then also the 5 years before that with the confidence supply. And, you know, there's not that much policy difference really between them. But now what we have is, on top of that, and that's going to be, I think, the unknown factor for the next 5 years, is a bunch of independents who are going to be, as they say, fighting very strongly for the constituencies and getting their constituencies things that it's not clear they should necessarily be getting ahead of others. And I think that's going to come up a lot.
I think the view is that once those deals are done at the beginning, though, that the independents will be rock solid, then more so than a party that might be full of, you know, uppity kind of people looking for policy and stuff. Mick, to go back to Alison O'Connor has a very scathing piece really about Verona Murphy in the Sunday Times.
Very much so. She calls it a grubby deal, the manner in which Verona Murphy got appointed. And she describes Michael Lowry as one of the most divisive figures in the Dáil, and I think that's all fair comment. She goes back into Verona's history, whereby in the by-election 2019, she suggested that children were being manipulated by ISIS. But particularly, I think what she touches on, this is interesting about her combative nature as a politician, and in one in particular, and this really illustrates it, where she was questioning Mary Butler, who was junior minister in the last government, about issues around our rescue services in in Wexford, the River Slaney, where there had been some people had gone into the river. And the comment she had to Mary Butler was, every time somebody ends up in the Slaney, you'll get your moment, which is, look, put
it's
it this
unfortunate,
way. Yeah,
for sure.
Put it this way. She should be given a chance to see how she performs. A lot of that stuff, she says she'll rise above it. And to be fair to her, she may well do, and she could well turn out to be a good appointment. But the premise for her appointment, I think, does leave a stain, particularly when there's cynicism about politics.
And Lorna, we're also seeing then a kind of a late dash from Kerry in the personification of the Healy Rays, who seem to be supporting this government as well, or certainly offering to, and it seems as if their offer might be being accepted.
Yeah, well, the quote that they have in the paper today is that government has made it very clear that they want us and they need us, and asked if they were willing to support. The answer was yes, once Kerry was looked after and provided for the people of Kerry. Look, the piece, I think, really boils back to, as Roa has said, you know, we shouldn't be about buying politics, or it shouldn't be around one constituency getting something over another when all of them are in need. And there was a quote from a Fianna Fáil TD in that piece, which is Claire Scott's piece in the Times, where it said, if we want a group to stay through thick and thin, we're going to have to buy them. That's just completely wrong to me. And back to your point earlier, Brendan, and I think it was a bit of a joke around, you know, policy or parties and people who care about policy. That's very much should be the priority here, not necessarily buying votes within Kerry or anywhere else.
I should say that the regional independent group have presented as well policies. They're concerned about the disabled and housing and
absolutely
all of those
and all of those things across the country are important, not just in Kerry.
Okay. There's also then we have discussion about who will be what in the new government, even though we keep being told that this is not important and all of that kind of thing. Lorna, just start us off on that. So Micheál and Simon will rotate ministry, according to John Lee in the Mail on Sunday. He's talking about the Ministry for Foreign Affairs.
Yeah, so look, I think it very much is that they're going to rotate that amongst themselves in their term as Taoiseach and Tánaiste.
So it is viewed, obviously, as the statesman-like thing for a person who has been Taoiseach or is about to be Taoiseach, that the most kind of respectable thing you could be around is foreign affairs.
Well, it's a very senior role and a very important role given the multiple crises that are taking place right across the world, you know.
It keeps him out of trouble as a party leader. It keeps him out of trouble rather than going into health or justice.
But are they not away a lot then, like, instead of kind of, you know, watering their own garden with the backbenchers?
I think the main thing is that when controversies arise, they won't be arising in their department and their party leader, so they can tend to keep everything
to keep Ireland on the moral high ground internationally that kind of thing. Yeah.
But just on that, on John Lee's piece, like, I think, you know, there was a lot of changes around, or a lot of suggestions around changes in terms of government and who could go where. There was potential suggestion that Darragh O'Brien might stay in housing. Maybe he wouldn't. But the one thing that I found absolutely astonishing, going through all the papers this morning, and now there's quite a lot of them, and I may miss it, and someone might text in to say that there is a specific reference on one particular page, but there was no reference that I could see to the Minister for Health. And given the crises that we have going on in health, there was no reference to where that should go or who that should be with. Now, I know earlier in the week there has been a lot of commentary around potentially Jennifer Carol McNeill and others. But, you know, given the importance of the Department of Health, I found it absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, I think there's a vague suggestion that Fianna Fáil would be willing to sacrifice having health in order to get justice. Emily, from your point of view as a medic, so we saw, I think some people thought it was kind of extraordinary that the last Minister for Health, very high profile person for the last number of years, did not manage to hold on to his seat. Was he viewed in your world as a good Minister for Health?
I think he was. Most of us in emergency medicine, the leadership had met Stephen along the way. He listened very well. He seemed to understand. And then definitely a couple of his policies did bear fruit. There's good recognition now about the several thousand new beds we need in hospital. That is government decision now. I suppose we're just nervous that that might be changed with the change in government, because that really needs to be expedited over the next few months rather than years. What was extraordinary for me was the complete absence of health in any of the discussion during the election. I'm only an observer, but other than the people of Limerick, the only people interviewed on the telly who mentioned anything about healthcare were the people of Limerick and worrying about Limerick Emergency Department. And other than that, I didn't hear any politician or any vox pop or anything mention concerns about health. And I was surprised.
Does that mean that in some way the heat has been taken out of the situation?
I don't know. I just thought it was. Yeah. I mean, day to day, I can talk about a few improvements that have happened. But looking still at the conditions, patients...
He managed to do a consultant contract, which many others had fallen on that ill. Was that a successful...
In my department now, we have new consultants in my department, and that has enabled us to treble up our consultants working over the Christmas New Year now. And that we're hoping that's going to be a game changer. So it's had a really good impact... In my
this evening. Is directly as a result of this new contract. And are these young Irish...
And the 50 new posts that he signed off for in emergency medicine.
And are these young Irish consultants choosing not to go abroad? Are some of them coming home?
Both.
Yeah.
So we have young doctors coming off our own training schemes who are now eligible to apply for consultant jobs. And if there's jobs to hold them here, it means they won't travel abroad for a consultant post. We're also getting the level of remuneration for the new consultant contract is making our jobs attractive for international graduates also. Particularly what's interesting for us is Northern Ireland graduates are expressing an interest. They might even be saying, well, I could maybe still live with the family in Newry,
okay,
but I'll commute down, because there is a big... salary difference now between what the NHS is paying and what the Republic is paying. So we think that was a good, that is good news.
Can I ask you one other question, and I'll come to Barra then? One of the other things, I suppose, that Stephen Donnelly chose to make his ministry about was about spending money more effectively in the health service, right? And linking your funding to productivity and actually bringing in kind of almost an elevated version of time and motion studies that he presumably learnt in his time in McKinsey or whatever. Was it starting to have any effect? And B, is there a load of time and money being wasted in the health service?
So I haven't seen any impact from the high level decisions that were made around changing the organisation, establishing the regional health authorities. I know I was on the Sláinte Care Advisory Council when, you know, that was discussed. I know the potential benefits of it organisationally. It had no impact on us yet. And yeah, the lack of IT, the lack of digital support for what I do every day. I write all the time. We have archaic forms of communication, bleeps. So all of that, I would say, what I should be doing every day is senior decision making. I shouldn't be looking for a printer that's working. I shouldn't be waiting for someone to answer a bleep. I shouldn't be looking for things. And so, yeah, I would think in my job, if I had someone come in as a case and say, what can we do to absolutely enable her to just make decisions all the time?
Yeah.
I think they'd have a field day.
A field day. Yeah. Barra, isn't that extraordinary to hear in a country where we are so incredibly wealthy and everything at the moment that the nuts and bolts don't seem to work in so many areas of Irish life?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I mean, on the healthcare side of thing, I remember at one point having three different hospital numbers in St. James's Hospital alone. Not to pick out St. James's, it's just where I was going. But, we don't have a single patient identifier yet that works across GPs and things. Yeah. It sounds like a bit of a boring point, but it means you go in there, they don't have all your healthcare at hand, they can't get all that information together. And that's something which, there is progress on, but it's slow. And it's something that really holds back knowing how we can best operate the system but also just getting those efficiencies that you're going to talk about. So,
and across the public service broadly, Barra, do we overstate the dysfunctionality of things here, infrastructure, all of that, or is it actually dysfunctional?
I think it is in places. And actually, one of those is, and some of it is we do it to ourselves. I mean, in terms of the process and procedure that we layer upon thing after thing. So there's a few stories actually in the paper today about this, in particular in relation to transport. But, talking about the delays to bus connects that have been going on. So that's the programme to radically kind of renew the bus structure and public transport structure around Dublin. But again, I remember actually it was about this time last year, I was sick just before COVID and up in my room and isolated. And so one of the things I did was to look through the various planning applications for the bus connects routes, these 12 different routes going to the city.
That's exactly what I did when I had COVID. I'd say so many people can identify with that. Yeah,
I'd
watched everything on Netflix. I said, what's next?
Bus connects. Yeah. But again, you have for the applications for these 12 different corridors, bus connects corridors, thousands and thousands of pages of environmental impact assessment for one of the ones that went out near us, out near kind of on the N4 out towards Lucan and Leixlip, it was reallocating space from a dual carriageway to a bus, and yet you require thousands and thousands of pages of an environmental impact assessment. We see the same thing actually. There's a challenge to the city traffic plan taking place that we saw during the week, and it's been challenged again, the reorganisation of the bus lanes in the city centre on the basis that there wasn't an environmental impact assessment done. So I think
that's one of the challenges
is this process, we do it to ourselves, we layer it upon it, and this is the thing that is in our own hands, right? There's plenty of stuff, and we'll talk about, I'm sure, later about all the external events that we have no control over.
Yeah.
But what we do have a control over, we should try fix, and we seem to be very, very slow at doing that.
Okay, so we segued away from politics there for a minute, but Lorna, I want to come back to politics for a minute, because the other half the country here did not vote for the government, and they voted for the likes of Sinn Féin, Labour. You're a member of the Labour Party. They voted for the Sock Dems and various others, right? And we've been watching them for the last couple of weeks. Can I ask you first, what were Labour at, like, this in and out? Not either demand to be spoken to and put into a government or say we're out, but I was actually thinking about coming out the day after Verona Murphy's coronation and then saying, well, actually, we're out now. It was like breaking up with someone the day after they got married to someone else and go, well, actually, I'm breaking up with you. I mean, it made them look kind of weak, did it?
Well, look, as you say, I'm a member of the Labour Party, but I'm not an elected official within the Labour Party who was involved in any of the discussions around programme for government or anything.
Do you think
like
Labour should have made more of an effort to go into government regardless?
I think Labour made a significant effort in terms of having conversations with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael around the policy issues that mattered to us that we went out and...
But were Labour not, weren't willing to go in unless the Sock Dems kind of sacrificed themselves as well and went in, were they?
Well, actually, I think the way you phrase it is actually the key point there. Nobody should be sacrificing themselves going in as a junior or a smaller party into government, but we've seen that happen time and time again. And so I think that the idea of a common platform of the left going in to negotiate a programme for government was a very solid one. One solid enough that Mary Lou MacDonald seems to be taking it now in terms of the language that she's using around opposition. So I think
the
Labour
solid
party,
idea expressed mainly by, in fairness, people before profit. Labour and the Soc Dems will have nothing to do with each other. They all seem to kind of feel Sinn Féin are not really people like them or something. So where's the...
I don't think it's Sinn Féin aren't people. So there's a couple of things there. The first on Sinn Féin and people not being people like them, I don't think that's the case. Like, I haven't looked and I went through the manifestos in great detail for all the different parties, partly because of my job and partly because it's my interest. And I do see significant differences when it comes to Labour's manifesto and Sinn Féin's manifesto, for example, whether you're talking about supports for Ukrainians, immigration, the living wage, climate change. There's significant differences there. And so I think when we talk about a common platform of the left, it needs to be on policies that we can align on and that we can agree on. The Soc Dems and Labour see that significantly.
May have that breathing space over the next 5 years to try. Yeah. You actually would be hopeful that
I think the only way that we can demonstrate that the future can be a party of the centre-left leading government.
Because you would think nobody saw that potential future in this election, did they?
I think it was very, like, I do think there was an awful lot of separation there and that wasn't, there wasn't a clear picture for people in terms of how that government could have been formed, and that's what we see in the outcome.
Mick, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times there. Well, you picked two pieces, one by Shane Coleman, who's giving a reasonably good bill of health to Sinn Féin going into 2025. Interesting though, MacDonald to shake up front bench, as Hugh O'Connell has in the Sunday Times. It's funny how the idea of a shake-up in the Sinn Féin front bench seems quite dramatic, because we're so used to the same people being there for so long now waiting to become the actual ministers.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. And having said that, though, if you look at the two principal people in the front bench, Ona Brin and Piers O'Doherty. Now, Ona Brin, a very capable person, I'm sure he'd do well elsewhere, but there'd be a general perception that he's serious level of expertise on housing, and therefore if he was to be moved out of there, you couldn't see that benefiting Sinn Féin in any big way.
And David Cullinan has a certain amount of credibility in health.
Absolutely.
Now,
he produced an alternative health proposals prior to the election that was very comprehensive. And Piers Doherty is regarded as being you could move Piers Doherty somewhere and he'd be as effective, but you'd wonder is this all a distraction, to be quite honest with you? I mean, Lauren from the fact that this business of United Left, what is United Left? Okay, you mentioned people before profit, they were the first ones to propose it. Let's face it, they wouldn't last a wet week in government. If you want an example of that, last week, the proposal of Mary Lou MacDonald for Taoiseach, which was an academic exercise, she was never going to get it. You had two from People Before Profit voting for her. You had one who's Solidarity, who's joined with them, abstaining. So they couldn't even agree on that. So genuine, and they're good individual people, nothing against them, but in terms of they're so ideologically pure, you could never see them lasting in government. Then you have the issue over Sinn Féin. Is Sinn Féin a left-wing party? I mean, on issues like immigration, climate change, on elements of taxation policy, they're closer to Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael than they would be to the Soc Dems. So their principal political objective is reunification of the country. So you have to put that into a mix where there's going to be a kind of a left-wing coalition, if you want to put it that way, whereas the likes of Labour and the Soc Dems have different priorities, which would be traditional left-wing objectives. So it's all a bit all over the shop.
Before we go to a break, Barra, as an economist, simple answer for me. Do we have a left-right divide in this country, or do we just have a bunch of people clustered on the side left of the centre?
Not meaningfully, I don't think. I think that's a fair kind of assessment of it, that we have kind of these little clumps and they don't differ that much meaningly. And I think one way of seeing that is on the proposals in the recent election around tax. So we had between them Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin and People Before Profit all pledging to gut the universal social charge in various ways. We had Sinn Féin claiming it was going to get rid of local property tax, our only effective tax on wealth. So, there's elements, I think, of the parties which do stand out as a little bit lefty, but there's also nothing really particularly right-wing in our politics, and that's you know, for better and for worse, and that, you know, that there's nothing on the far right like there is in many of mainland European countries. At the same time, there isn't really, I suppose, a party to give voice to some people who maybe want a smaller state and lower taxes. Instead, all the parties are promising them lower taxes, larger state and more spending, and we can all just carry on our merry way.
And you see, we're in the fortunate position of being able to have it all now. We don't have to make those difficult choices for now. Okay, Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Dr. Emily O'Connor and Barra Rowntree staying with us. We'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Dr. Emily O'Connor and Barra Rowntree. And we go to what was a huge international story this week. Lorna, maybe you'd start us on this. I think the piece you picked about Gisele Pellico is the Sunday Times piece. Did you look at the Brenda Power piece there? Brenda has, I thought, a very strong piece on how Gisele Pellico is a perfect victim, but does she represent all the imperfect victims as well? That it's easy to get up in arms about Gisele Pellico.
I actually, to be honest, Brendan, I found it really difficult reading Brenda's piece because of the language within it, to be honest. The idea of a perfect victim just, and the language of that seems mad to me.
I think she's using it though in the sense to make a point though,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but yeah. I think we need to be mindful of our language when it comes to these extremely difficult cases as well.
Yeah, okay.
Because later on in the piece she speaks of less perfect victims and so on, and anyone who's a victim of rape and sexual assault and so on, you know, I just think we need to be mindful of the language in which we use around these. But yes, I think there was a really hard hitting piece, or a really hard hitting line within it, where she speaks of Gisele and I suppose the reaction from French, Spanish and German leaders who were lauding her for giving voice to female victims, but at the same time they sit down alongside the Taliban and alongside world leaders like Iranian leaders and so on. And, you know, has she been able to really move the dial when it comes to the change that we actually need to see outside of the virtue signal, or you know,
yeah.
And I think that is a very legitimate point to make.
And do you think, has it moved the dial? I suppose more importantly, a big conversation that was going on this week, and indeed Gisele Pellico's son came out and said it himself. He said men need to come into this
absolutely
conversation.
And that's the thing. So this conversation needs to happen in all walks of life and in all groups, because the one thing that I think the case in France absolutely demonstrates is that, and we hear it all the time, not all men. Yes, absolutely not all men, but men from all walks of life. And that's what that case really demonstrates to us. Mm. And that's where we need to be able to say, have these conversations in our homes, in our friends groups, all across the board. And we need to be calling this out. And that's absolutely true. And no, we haven't seen the legal changes that we need to. And there needs to be an absolute right across the world. In fairness, in Ireland, there has been some significant progress made. And I will always give credit to Minister McEntee for the work that she has done in that space in trying to improve the circumstances here in Ireland, but we are far from perfect, and that is the same right across the
yeah
world.
And you know, people keep talking about how brave she was, and then you kind of think, yeah, but she shouldn't have to be brave.
And yeah, Bruno, what I really heard from all this is the reversal of shame. I suppose I grew up in the 1970s Ireland, and there was an awful lot of shame associated with even getting pregnant if you weren't married, or you really would never have admitted you were sexually assaulted because it was the asking for it, etc. And I think, of course, my daughters don't carry that with them. So I think this is it's a great part of that journey of taking the shame away from the people, the victims, and giving it back to
Emily. Do you come across in your work people who have just been victims of sexual assault?
Yes. Now we aren't a sexual assault unit.
Yeah.
All of that specialist work goes on for us. It's in the Rotunda, but yes, we would get young men and young women in, and I suppose some of the most difficult ones are that they can't remember. They can't remember if something happened, and you know, to how much do you open that can of worms? Mm. So yes, we will have young people come in who are deeply unconscious because of drugs, alcohol, etc. Might have some injuries that might make us think, perhaps, were you assaulted? And yet those, sometimes children can't remember. So that is difficult, yeah.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. So look, in the spirit of the conversation this week, I would ask the men here, I know, like, look, always with these stories, men can be reluctant to speak in this forum here because they feel it's a time to be listening and everything. But Mick, did it make you think?
It made me think about younger men today, Brendan, and the fact that the law is catching up. Has the culture caught up yet? Mm. And I just don't know, you know, but it is definitely something that thankfully has gone through a sea change from 30, 40 years ago in this country, quite possibly in France, not as much, or other Western countries would vary. But I just wonder, has the culture come as far as it can? The whole notion of respect, of consent, these issues, to what extent they are actually taught to, young men in particular, and whether they're integrated properly into our culture yet. And that's just, it's an ongoing thing, but we'd want to hurry up. Like.
But you know what, I think as well, is there not an issue that we can be teaching it from a top-down level to the young people, but there is a cultural
attitude among them
that is horizontal, like it's not coming vertically from the,
absolutely.
From the top.
And there is
and online.
Like I have to say, in terms of, like I know from a previous life, in terms of USI and in third level institutions, there is phenomenal work happening. Dr. Louise Crowley down in UCC and many others are doing Trojan work in terms of trying to have peer-to-peer led conversations, because you're right, Brendan, it's not about being spoken down to or being, you know, lectured or finger wagged, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but do we have a hope against the internet, Lorna?
Obviously there is a huge amount of regulation that is required in terms of internet, and that's a whole different conversation. But we do need to have those people who are willing to challenge those conversations. They're happening in their own friends group, in person. And then that, over time, alongside regulation and all of that kind of thing, will have to catch
up. It's multifaceted. Yeah. Barry, did it make you think?
I did. And just horrendous reading it and listening to just what you went through. But I thought it was really powerful as well, the reversal of shame. So I think there's lots of talk of shame switching sides during the week, and that I found incredibly powerful. But also there's a piece, it's not in the paper today, but I think it's on the Journal early in the week, from the head of Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, talking about some of the, I suppose, issues here that many survivors face. And one of them that I found absolutely flabbergasting was, it's still the case that the notes in counselling can be accessed.
Yeah, so are they not working on fixing that?
There's lots of, I suppose,
but it's extraordinary,
changes,
isn't
but
it?
Barra's right, like it's absolutely madness that the victim's counselling notes can be used by the defence, or can be used by the prosecution, against the victim as part of the defence. And bearing in mind that a rape victim in court has no legal representation, mm-hmm. you know. Now, that is all things that are in the process of being changed.
So the best that the victim/survivor of rape can hope for is that somebody from the Rape Crisis Centre be there with them as a support.
Yeah.
But they are basically, they are a witness.
Yes,
essentially,
in the
crime.
Which is different to how it was taking place in France, in that, you know, she, Giselle had representation there with her, legal representation. She wasn't just a witness to it; she was kind of part of it. And again, that different legal approaches, whatever. But it does kind of reflect maybe a different way of approaching
the issue. And for all we talked about the culture in France being maybe a bit behind the rest of the world, that is interesting that there was that aspect to it. Mick, the days of when people being called out from the pulpit would finish them off are probably gone. But the Sunday Times front page, we have Conor McGregor being called out from the pulpit.
Yeah, this is Eamon Martin, I think the bishop, making a point that people like Conor McGregor hijacking religion. They are using religion, makes reference to religion, and not just him, but there's others, so-called influencers. And the bishop's making the point that you know, this isn't religion at all. They're basically hijacking it, and they're using it for their own purposes, for often activity that would be as far from religion, any kind of organised religion, as you can imagine. And he singled out Conor McGregor for particular mention there.
Yeah. Okay, Lorna, you were looking at that as well.
Yeah, look, I think back to our earlier conversation there, we need to be approaching these challenges from all angles and multifaceted approaches and so on. So, you know, it's not often I agree with the church, but absolutely more than happy to agree here to say, yes, calling out that type of behaviour is absolutely warranted. But I do think maybe, you know, there's a bit of naivety in terms of, are they actually going to be reaching the audiences that Conor McGregor's posts are reaching? And I think that's a question that I don't think has a positive answer.
Well, maybe it's it's clever on the church sure, to pick the right target and actually find people like you who wouldn't normally necessarily agree with the church.
Absolutely, fully, as I say, fully all on board we with need them. To
yeah. Speaking of the church, one of the actually biggest talking points of the week, in a strange way, was Maria Cahill's writing about it today. The RIP.ie story. So, Barry, you were looking at this. So, just explain the background to this, maybe for people who aren't aware.
Sure. So, I think the wider Irish Times Group took over RIP.ie, the website, which has existed for many years now. I feel like I've not known, almost death without it. that long. Which was essentially, you could post up information of the passing of loved one, and kind of, you know, funeral directors did it, and you got very nice, and lots of people liked this, the comments and condolences at the end.
It became a huge part of Irish life and death, actually, didn't it? Like, it was dug into the culture there all over the country.
It did, but again, given there are many, many parts of the country where people listen to the death notices religiously, or not religiously sometimes, I suppose it's not surprising in a way. But so RIP.ie has been bought out, and they're looking at changing then their model. So previously they ran on the basis of advertisements, like much else on the internet, and now it's looking like changing towards, there's going to be a fee if you post a notice on this. And so it doesn't seem, you know, particularly much. It's about €100, but it's caused uproar. I was listening to a good discussion on radio during the week between a funeral director and a priest. The funeral director took great pleasure in pointing out that the Dublin diocese had jacked up their own fees during the last few years as well. So they're not the only one to RIP.ie aren't the only ones to be charging or kind of. But you know, death is expensive. And we shouldn't forget that there are grants in place for people who don't have the money to kind of cover those. The fees and costs around debt, so it's another small increase around the cost of it, but I'm not sure it's by any means the largest one.
Mickey, you and me are old enough to remember when newspapers used to make money, and they used to make a lot of money on classifieds and debt notices. And you weren't getting your debt notice for €100,
no,
even back in the day, like.
Absolutely not, Brendan. I think this is a thing that's been kicked up by funeral directors and undertakers. And what I would love to know, for a sense of balance, is the kind of margins that there are in that sector, because the fact that they couldn't absorb €100, and we're talking about funerals can cost, we're talking 5,000 plus, I'd imagine, well over it, why they couldn't absorb this cost when they're not paying for any debt notice in newspapers as they used to. And when it is an actual excellent service, to the extent that people, and we've seen this particularly in condolence pages from all over the world, can make contact and express. Now, Maria Cahill has an interesting suggestion. It is interesting. She's suggesting that one alternative way of doing it is to charge a nominal fee to leave a condolence, because people, she's described as debt trawlers with morbid curiosity, leaving strange messages like, well, I didn't know the person who's dead, I'm sure they were a nice person and what have you, that kind of thing. That's a possible alternative too. But I have to say, I've no problem with it. I mean, on the basis, you often see it just working in newspapers, you often see a scenario whereby people are on social media and they want to click on to a police and say, oh, I can't get on it, it's behind the paywall, how dare they? It's like, because it's on social media or whatever, everything should be for free. And this is another example. Why should it be for free? And it's a very nominal fee that they're asking undertakers to pay.
I'll tell you one thing, if they start charging for putting in condolences, right, there are certain TDs in certain parts of the country, and I'm talking a very wide geographical area they cover now, like, because like I'm from Cork, which is, it's far enough from Kerry, like, but I'm just saying there are some TDs who'd be racking up a lot of charges on condolences.
My ma, I think, Lorna, we need the revolution, to be honest. I find this a really interesting one, and I suppose I would love to know, like, there's huge amounts of advertising and so on takes place on that site. So I'd love to know what the actual...
It seems it was only making...
47,000.
Yeah. Okay. So they weren't making huge money from advertising. But look, there is no doubt it will survive, because I think it has become as much part of the cultural landscape as...
There's competition out there. Somebody had it up last night, I see that on Twitter, that there's already competition coming to replace the free... advertise or free site online, so we'll have to wait and see, I think.
Okay, all right, we'll take a break. Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Emily O'Connor, and Barry Rowntree staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Get into the festive spirit with amazing Christmas value at Aldi. In-store December 20th from $8.99, a full range of fresh turkeys, including premium free-range bronze and slow-grown whole turkeys. All 100% Irish and Board Beer quality assured. Fresh Super 6 fruit and veg like Brussels sprouts, carrots and parsnips, only 49 cent each. And unbeatable value on Prosecco Frassante, now only $6.21. Cheers! Aldi, have a cracking Christmas. While stocks last, get the facts, be drinkaware, visit drinkaware.ie.
Recreational drugs can give you a different buzz, but they can all impair your driving. Some drugs can slow down your reactions, leaving you prone to error.
Other drugs can make you more aggressive.
More aggressive.
More aggressive. And overconfident behind the wheel. So you make rash judgments.
Drive too fast.
And take dangerous risks.
Drug driving can endanger you, your passengers and other road users. Never ever drive under the influence of drugs. A message from the Road Safety Authority. Visit rsa.ie.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Mick Clifford, Lorna Fitzpatrick, Dr. Emily O'Connor and Barra Rowntree. Dr. Emily O'Connor, can I lean into your expertise and lived experience now for a minute? So what is the situation in A&Es around the place at the moment as we come towards Christmas?
So I'm going to start with some good news, which I know is unexpected of me, but a couple of really good things happening. The introduction of RSV vaccination for newborn babies has changed this bronchiolitis season. There's been a huge reduction in the numbers of babies being admitted to hospital with bronchiolitis. So that's a huge good news story.
Were there a lot of babies coming in bad
states?
So
it would be, I don't do paediatrics, but for hospitals that admit babies, this would be bronchiolitis season, and we'd have significant numbers of babies being required for oxygen and feeding because of bronchiolitis.
Okay. So a lot of distress being saved there as well, because I'd imagine that's very distressing for everyone.
Now, the figures aren't all together on that, but that's going to be a really good news story.
Excellent.
Another one that I would like to point out as a good news story is that 8 children from Gaza arriving for healthcare in Ireland. And I know, reading some of the social media posts on this, there are people who would say we shouldn't be doing this if we can't look after our own kids in the country. But look, I think it's good news. The mark of us, of humanity, is not only helping other people when we have an excess ourselves. It's actually helping other people even when you are stressed.
And not only talking about how terrible it is what's happening to other people either.
Yes.
Do something about it.
So
yeah.
those 8 kids coming in, I think, is a good news story for health.
Okay.
Slightly more bad news ones then are the our flu is just, we're probably going to hit the peak of the flu epidemic early this year. The UK are bang in the middle of it at the moment, so we're looking at it hitting us in the next 2 weeks, which from the point of view of hospitals and GP, they are difficult times of the year to staffing wise and etc. to actually accommodate a flu peak.
Okay.
So that's going to be difficult.
So they're going to be glad they had an election before Christmas, are they?
Okay. And then there is a lovely article in the Sunday Indo covering a few workers who are working Christmas Day. So it's just to remind everybody that there's a huge number of people who aren't signing off for Christmas this weekend, who will be working all over the Christmas. And I know I'm working Christmas Eve and Christmas Eve night, and I think all of the doctors I'm working with, bar one, are not Irish born. And if it wasn't for all our non-Irish trained, non-Irish born doctors and indeed nurses, the health system would be coming to a close over Christmas.
Okay, and let us not forget how we used to, how we went through that period of appreciating our frontline healthcare workers so much. Can I ask you just briefly, because it is something that people probably don't think of, that story, it's in the Sunday Independent, I think it's elsewhere as well, by Lynn Kelleher.
Yes.
About end-of-life care in A&E departments. And you see, it's not something we think of, but people do die in A&E, and I presume in fairly awful circumstances sometimes.
Yes, so all of us would have a death at least every 24 hours. So some of those deaths are really unexpected. Something catastrophic has happened. Someone dies very quickly. And there is probably little we can do to allow that death happening in anything other than the resuscitation room or something like that. But there are an awful lot more patients who, if we had better planning, advanced care planning, etc., people, we could have organised around this patient to allow them die somewhere else.
Yeah, and their family.
So I can only... so yes, we have patients dying in cubicles and it is noisy and families have no privacy. We do our best to get them up to rooms on the wards, if, let's say, if we have a few hours maybe to organise things. But those patients suffer from the lack of bed capacity just like any other patient.
Yeah, but that's an awful end.
And it's just to remember
everyone.
Again that, you know, Christmas Day, for all its joy, will be the worst day of their lives for a lot of people because...
Okay.
You know, yeah. So EDs keep going all the time over Christmas, and there will be deaths in every hospital in the country on Christmas Day. So it's just to put the balance on it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good to you always make that point that the people you see in an A&E, they're possibly experiencing the worst moments of their life. So all the more reason that we should have our A&Es working as well as possible. Bara, can I lean into your expertise now a little bit and ask you, because there seem to be a lot of conflicting signals around the economy, both globally and in Ireland. So as we head into 2025, would you give us a few minutes of an outlook?
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one, I suppose.
Keep it positive. No, I'm joking. Hit us between the eyes with it.
In many ways, it is positive, right? We've kind of come out of a period of very high inflation where prices have been rising rapidly. People have kind of felt their income squeezed. That's kind of come to a halt. So prices haven't gone down, but they've stopped rising. So that's something. The public finances look exceptionally good, but they're kind of bolstered by this handful of American multinationals. So it really is kind of astonishing. But this year, we're probably going to take in about 6,000 per person in the country in corporation tax receipts. And most of that is coming from just a handful of American multinationals. And so that really is kind of keeping things going, and it's bolstering things, but it's great as long as it keeps coming in. And so in that sense, it's kind of things are looking good. There's reasons to be positive.
Okay. The headwinds?
But there's lots of headwinds ahead, and they're not really in our control. And I think that's the most kind of that's the most worrying thing. So we've got so much depends with what happens in the US with Trump, with tariffs and tax reform, and particularly on those corporations.
And we have no idea at the moment, do we, if the Trump administration is going to be fiscally conservative or Trump is looking to put up the debt ceiling and spend, and all of that will make huge differences to the whole world, will it?
It will, and again, there is trying to get a handle onto what bit of the Republican Party is in ascendance at whatever time, or whether Elon Musk is in charge or Trump or whatever. It is really, really confusing.
So literally, depending on complete unknowns in January, our lives could change hugely next year.
They could, and again, we're really exposed. So we're a small, open economy. We've done very well from increasing amount of trade, and that we're very exposed to what happens in trade with the US. And so if Donald Trump comes in, and as him and some of the people around him have said, they want to, and replace a bunch of their taxes with just tariffs, that could really, really hit us. If he decides that, like many of the people around him have pointed out, that, well, why are these American multinationals giving several thousand of euro per year to every Irish person, and they should be paying that in the US? Now, difficult to change. He has to get it through Congress, and they won't always do what he says. But we do have these headwinds. And so from that point of view, we really should be trying to be sensible ourselves, so have credible and cautious spending plans, not ramp up spending off the back of these corporation tax receipts, which eventually will go, hopefully not in the next few years and hopefully not suddenly, but they will go eventually.
Okay.
And we
so you would hope that the incoming government breaks a lot of their promises?
I should hope so. During the election, it was mad what we saw. We had all the parties out promising practically all the parties, not all the parties, but promising to, they're going to be fiscally prudent while increasing expenditure at record levels never seen before. And then the other thing we need to do is just fix what we can ourselves. So around all that planning, that procedure, that process that we layer upon ourselves, if we're ever going to solve the housing crisis, the climate measures that we need to take place, the energy infrastructure, the transport infrastructure, we really need to fix how limited and the limitations we put on ourselves to actually do those.
So there are controllables in all of this. Okay. Mick, the Skelligs.
Yes, Brendan, the Ken Fox is in a couple of newspapers. He has reports off the Public Works about issues around the Skelligs. One two elements in my thing are fascinating. One, exhausted kayakers arriving on the pier. You're talking about, no, I'm fairly familiar with the area. The kayakers going from Port McGeer, Ballinskellig, or wherever, out to the Skellig. They should be in the Olympics, because that's just crazy stuff altogether. But even more interesting is that there's a smell of weed inside in the monastery on the Skellig Rock, as smelt by one of the guides. And it makes me wonder, with all this talk of kind of behind closed doors talks going on in politics, are some of our major politicians getting together, kayaking out to the Skelly, getting into the monastery and talking over affairs of state under the waft of weed?
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, people are trying to have a spiritual experience, exactly, out there, I suppose, yeah, and yeah, that's how some people do that. We'll finish up with a bit of sport. Emily, you were at the rugby match yesterday. Poor old Connacht had Leinster and the referee against them, according to themselves, I think.
Thank you for the opportunity, Brendan. I don't often go to rugby matches, but we were hollering for Connacht yesterday because my husband's grandnephew, Piers O'Connor, it's in the name, was playing for Connacht yesterday. So we went out to the Leinster Cauldron, that is Lansdowne, and roared ourselves silly for Connacht, as in I'm slightly hoarse today, yesterday. So it is a Leinster Cauldron. It was hard for them walking out every time onto the Aviva pitch. So I think they did themselves proud, and you know, shout out to them. Thank you.
Yeah, God, you know, you're not getting any younger when your grand nephew is playing for Ireland. I actually became a granduncle in the last few years, and I feel like some kind of old fella. But at least they're not playing for their province yet. Okay, thank you all very much. And as I say, thank you for coming in on this weekend before Christmas. Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Lorna Fitzpatrick, Public Affairs Accounts Director at Instinctive Partners. Dr. Emily O'Connor, Consultant in Emergency Medicine in Connolly Hospital. Barra Rowntree, Economist in Trinity College Dublin. Thank you all, guys, and happy Christmas. And it's just coming up to 12 noon now, and we will go to the newsroom and Karen Carthy.